So nice to have you back, Pep.
Enormous pleasure, Niman.
Let's get started with what's going on right now between Russia and NATO. In Ukraine, they're talking, they're looking for some sort of permission on the part of NATO to hit, to use these long-range missiles against Russia. Putin was talking about this, and he said, he pointed out that if they use these missiles, it means that NATO is at war with Russia. It's not anymore Ukrainians, because they're not capable of using these long-range missiles. It has to be NATO army firing these missiles at Russia. That would change the nature of this conflict. What's your take?
This is immensely important. Maybe diplomatically, extremely diplomatic, and it was off-the-cuff interview in St. Petersburg, in front of the Hermitage, in fact. And it was a minute and a half, not more than that. But Putin went straight to the point. Of course, Putin, the Kremlin, the agencies here in Russia, everybody knows that this permission to hit targets inside the Russian Federation with Western missiles, not only America's, but Storm Shadow and Scalp, Anglo-French, this is already on. So now there is the kabuki theater of selling this to public opinion. The order has already been given and the green light has already been given. We don't know what's going to happen next because it depends on what does Ukraine have on Ukrainian soil. Not much, not many Storm Shadows and Scalps. And the Americans, because they are extremely cautious and scared to death, of course, they are saying that they will not allow Ukraine to use attack MS, American attack MS. So this, the onus will fall once again on the Europeans, because the Europeans are the patsies in this whole gigantic scenario. For instance, another example, a very good friend of mine and one of the best independent analysts in Europe, Professor Andrea Zoc of the University of Milan. He wrote the preface of one of my books that was published in Italy earlier this year. Andrea posted something. It's on my Telegram. It's in Italian, but you can easily read on instant translation on Telegram, saying that the U.S. can they can allow themselves to be on the background because they have two patsies fighting the war for them. The first one is being completely eviscerated, Ukraine. And the second one is the Europeans in NATO, which is exactly what we're going to see with the order that is already on, of course, of using the Storm Shadows and the Scalps. If this if one of these attacks, at least one of these attacks inside the Russian Federation has scores of Russian civilian deaths, then finally we can say with certainty that the Russian response is going to be devastating. And it will be against NATO. And it will be against NATO bases outside of Ukraine. And who's going to pay the price? The Brits and the French. The Brits, especially because they are coordinating this whole NATO escalation of dementia, let's put it this way. They have one department and several sub-departments of the MI6 working under the foreign ministry in London, coordinating the war against Russia. So we can say tacitly, directly, that the UK is at war with Russia for quite a while now, any direct war. So this is only the last of scores of red lines, but this one is very, very serious because it involves not mere drone attacks against the Russian Federation. They happen practically every day, even here in Moscow this past few days. But with long-range missiles and deep into Russia, it's a completely different story. And we know, because we know how demented Bankova in Kiev, these people, SBU, everybody around Zelensky, etc., how absolutely lunatics they are. These won't be military installations. This will include civilians as well inside the Russian Federation, even though theoretically the Ukrainians have to ask permission for the, especially the Brits and the French, to, you know, the coordinates, the satellite operation, and even launching the missiles, because they don't have officials in Ukraine as sufficiently capable to do that. But if there are Russian civilian casualties, then all bets are off, Nima, really. And this is where we are at the moment. And that's why this is so serious. And the way Putin, in this a minute and a half or so interview, he put it calm as a Taoist monk, once again, dealing with a bunch of rabid hyenas. But, you know, he went straight to the point. Look, if you do this, we'll respond accordingly, which was a very diplomatic way of saying it, you know, run for cover, cowards.
And how do they perceive the latest visit of Antony Blinken together with David Lammy to Ukraine? And do you think that in their understanding, they're trying to escalate the situation, or they're trying to bring some sort of sanity to Zelensky administration?
No, Nima, they know that the visit was part of the giant kabuki. The kabuki is to organize the visit, to go to Kiev, talk to Kiev, and then discuss the possibility of these long-range missiles attacks, when everybody knows that this decision has already been made. So it's an enormous kabuki. It's a series of provocations. And we in fact, you can track the whole war against Russia, the proxy war in Ukraine, as one provocation after another, starting even before 2014 in Maidan. And after Maidan, it was really one provocation after another, non-stop. So Russia has been, you know, it's in terms of high-level diplomacy, it's an example for history of how to be immensely restrained when you are dealing with a bunch of lunatics, Atlanticist, cross-Atlantic lunatics, and especially those ones that we cannot say that they are Nazis. If you say that they are Nazis in Kiev, we are immediately blocked or canceled. So I'm not going to say they are Nazis. I'm going to say they're just a bunch of wonderful lunatics in Kiev. You know, but this is a series of provocations. And now we come to, considering everything that came in this past few years and months, the NATO Wunderwaffen and all that, this is really, really serious. This is long-range missiles directly against the Russian Federation. So this is the ultimate provocation. And Putin, once again, so restrained, diplomatically said, look, you better think twice about this. You're not going to like the results. But will they listen? Of course not, because we know they are all a bunch of lunatics. And the most important thing, in fact, the overarching dimension of the whole thing, the elections in the US in November. Simply, in terms of optics, for the whole American population, even if they don't even know what they're voting for, and even if they know that whatever they vote, their vote doesn't count, this current administration simply cannot afford to be totally devastated in Ukraine. So they need something. And they came out of their rabbit's hat. Let's attack inside Russia, because this will provoke a response, a serious response by Putin, and we can blame him for the whole thing. So that will be a diversionist tactic before the elections in early November. If we have what we have at the moment, which is the front collapsing all the way across Novorossiya, and the Kursk dementia being finally contained, and now it's blow back, Harris, it's very simple. Cackling Kamala Harris loses the election, period. And they know that. They are absolutely freaking out. But the only, just to give you and our audience the spectrum of the whole dementia, this is the best that they come up with. An absolutely crazy, irrational escalation, knowing that if this gets out of control, the Russian response will be devastating. So this is where we are at the moment. We are all hostages, once again, of the lunatics across the spectrum, from Washington to NATO in Brussels to Bankova in Kiev.
It seems to me that they're doing everything to provoke Russia to mm-hmm. go to the western part of Ukraine. But we know at the end of the day, Russia is so smart, they're not going to do that, because they want to make an Afghanistan-like situation for Russia just to trap them in the western part of Ukraine with these ultra-nationalist groups in Ukraine. And how do you see this concept? How do they find it right now? Because there has to be something. It's all really, when they're talking about these long-range missiles, it's all about the 2024 presidential election. Is about provoking Russia to go to the western part of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It's an attempt on the part of the United Kingdom to involve the United States even more, because they know if Trump wins, he's not interested in Ukraine. How do you find it?
All of the above, Nima. In fact, you just lined up the main reasons for all that. Apart from the overarching reason, which is the US and NATO simply cannot afford to lose in Ukraine. And when they look at the actual facts on the ground, they are freaking out, but on a cosmic level. So they have what? Half of September and October. So a month, early November. So a little over a month and a half. Let's say little over 6 weeks to try to come up with something. And once again, the something is an absolutely dreadful and extremely dangerous escalation. And at the same time, they entertain the notion that we could have a ceasefire, which obviously the current administration in the US can sell as a sort of victory. The Russians are not going to fall for this trap as well, because they know what a ceasefire means. Means freezing the war as the battlefield is configured now, which doesn't solve anything, offering something that the Russians know that they cannot trust anything the Americans say or do or write or promise, or because they break every deal, every single one of them, of having a guarantee that Ukraine is not going to become part of NATO. But the real target, of course, is a pause in the whole thing, so they can remilitarize Ukraine and remilitarize NATO as well, which is being completely demilitarized by the Russian meat grinder. So this is what's ahead of us. The possibility, okay, let's say plan A is this completely demented escalation. Plan B is, okay, we can always talk to them about a possible ceasefire, which is a pause and then remilitarization. Blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, the objective will be a new war against Russia in 2025, 26, all the way to maybe the big, big, big war, which is being planned for around 2030. NATO, in NATO conceptually, has already, they have, you know, they wrote reports about it, estimates, they congregated all the think tanks and all that. They know that there's got to be a big, big war against Russia around 2030, because then they think they will be at the top of their powers. This is the way they think, huh? All right, I'm quoting them, essentially. So this is where we are at the moment, between something that could get totally out of control because of the escalation. And of course, this another kabuki, the kabuki of a possible ceasefire, which the Russians are not going to fall into this trap.
We had a report in RIA Novosti. They were talking about the Pentagon is studying the use of nuclear, the effect of nuclear weapons on the agricultural sector in the eastern part of Europe and Russia. How, in your opinion, what does it mean when they're talking about this and studying these type of weapons? Do they really think of having a greater war, a nuclear war, or it's something that is not that related to the conflict right now?
It is directly related with the overarching war, which is essentially once again, and we have been having this for what, 300 years at least, the West trying to attack, dismember, and plunder Russia. It's always the same plot, Nima, with a different, slightly different actors from one century to another. And now we have the Fourth Reich in Europe, which is basically NATO controlling the EU, allied with the Americas. So it is a collective West in different gradations. Once again, now it's the collective West against Russia. And of course, when they look at everything on the ground, the fact that everything that they thought would happen after the start of the SMO in February 2022 never happened and had no chance of happening. The Russian economy now is several indicators, the third largest by PPP on the planet. They have already overtaken Japan and Germany, and they are growing. And they will continue to grow. Not only that, they have a national development project to what we were discussing in Vladivostok last week, developing the whole Far East and the Arctic at the same time with direct federal input and lots of investment. BRICS. Russia and China are the leaders of BRICS. We're going to have the summit next month in Kazan, where the BRICS are going to be talked about all over the planet as finally there is an alternative to forever wars and the dementia by the hegemon and the vassals in Europe. You know, so when they look at all that, they are desperate. Sputin of Russia of SWIFT, so what? Systems of alternative payment systems are being discussed and will start to be implemented among the BRICS and expanding to the rest of the global south. So they cannot boast a single victory since the start of the big provocation of forcing Russia to intervene in the Donbass in 2022. So this gives you an idea of how this bunch of headless chickens are feeling at the moment, right?
Yeah. And how do you see... You talk about BRICS, and we know that recently Serbia was talking about if the European Union is not letting us in, and it doesn't seem that they're feeling that they're going to be part of the European Union in the future. That's why they're talking about BRICS right now. Do you think it's serious in their mind, or just they're talking about it just to force the European Union to accept them?
Well, there was something that was very, you know, among the discussions in Vladivostok, I was discussing with the top level French analyst who used to teach the war school, you know, the war and the war scholars in France until he was canceled because he was too independent. And he was saying, you know what? Should happen in the short, in the middle to long run, France should abandon NATO and join BRICS, because it has everything to do with the French Gaullist notion of independence. It's not something so at the moment. This is the most far-fetched thing you can imagine. But if you look around 2030, 2035. Not so far-fetched. It could happen, depending on the next French governments after the absolute debacle of the current little king, who was ordered by his masters to destroy France from the inside, which is his doing, and to align France completely with the dementia in Brussels by the European Commission and NATO. So, you know, that's it's not the tactical victory at the moment of the empire, which is an enormous tactical victory, destroying Europe from the inside and making the European Union a complete vassal of the US. So the Americans succeeded in that in less than 2 years. Congratulations. But this doesn't mean that this is going to last long term. There are discussions among very well-connected German independents, for instance, that sooner or later, we're going to be talking to Russia again. Within, you know, the, if not the next, but, you know, the in a few years, another German government, of course, because they need it and they are complementary. It's a matter of high-level manufacturing and cheap energy, which was working brilliantly until a few years ago. And German industrialists know that. The German ruling class knows that. So this will happen sooner or later. And the French, of course, will see that they are betting on the wrong horse sooner or later as well. So all these changes are essential in Europe. And that explains, directly connected to what we're discussing, why NATO, in the minds of the conceptualizers in Washington, should be essentially focused on London, Warsaw, the demented Poles, the Baltic midgets, no offense to midgets, on the contrary, and the Scandinavians. Yes, Norway, Sweden, and especially Finland. Because now, the latest elections, the Americans managed to put their number one puppet as president of Finland, Stubb, who is essentially a absolutely demented Russophobe with very close French-English connections. And he will be more or less organizing from now on harassment of Russia from Scandinavia, and very closely connected with the Swedes. For instance, practical example, they are bombing a military airport near Murmansk for the second day. So they are bombing this airport already, you know, day after day. And the whole thing starts from a Finnish airport. And apparently there are Swedish fighters involved as well. So this is a Swedish-Finland operation harassing Russia in the Arctic. This is just the beginning. It's going to get much more. This was discussed also in Vladivostok last week on some of the roundtables about the Arctic Silk Road or Northern Silk Route, which Russia is investing a lot to make it viable, building more nuclear icebreakers. And in a matter of years, this is going to be much more important than the Suez Canal. So this adds an extra layer of dementia to the NATO actors, you see? So this whole thing is progressing towards, there will be inevitably, assuming that NATO doesn't collapse before, which is also a possible scenario, there will be a major replay of Hitler in the Second World War, now with the American and European forcing a war against Russia. And the horizon is more or less 2030. So what we're seeing now is just the starter in the menu. We haven't even reached the salad part yet, Nima. Not to mention the main dish.
What's so amazing right now about Europe, and it doesn't matter if Trump wins or Kamala wins, because mm-hmm. they're gonna lose drastically. And when you look at both of Democratic Party and Republican Party, they don't consider Europe as a major player. But when it comes to Ukraine, it seems to me that they are willing to sacrifice Europe in order to inflict suffering on Russia. And after this, you watched the debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
Snippets. The whole thing would be too much. I will probably kill myself.
It wasn't that much of change, because the only difference was the conflict in Ukraine, that Donald Trump was willing to put an end to it. But here is J.D. Vance talking about what would be that plan, how they're going to implement this plan.
And Ukraine wants this war to end. Yeah. Europe, which, by the way, has underfunded this war while American taxpayers have been very generous to the Ukrainians, the Europeans want this war to end because it's jacking up their energy prices. So I think what this looks like is Trump sits down. He says to the Russians, the Ukrainians, the Europeans, you guys need to figure out what does a peaceful settlement look like. And what it probably looks like is something like the current line of demarcation between Russia and Ukraine. That becomes like a demilitarized zone. It's heavily fortified so the Russians don't invade again. Ukraine remains its independent sovereignty. Russia gets the guarantee of neutrality from Ukraine. It doesn't join NATO. It doesn't join, you know, some of these sort of allied institutions. And I think that's ultimately what this looks like. And by the way, the Germans and other countries have to fund some Ukrainian reconstruction.
Yeah. Look at Germany. Look at Germany.
Well, Germany. J.D. Vance has less than zero knowledge of international relations and foreign policy. Number one. Number two, and number two is much more worrying. He's already selling the plan. He's already selling the ceasefire plan. This is essentially the Trump ceasefire plan, which the Russians won't fall for, period. But you see how the campaign has already started. And that was a Freudian slip. J.D. Vance was an invention of Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is deep, deep, deep U.S. deep state. So that tells you the whole story, right? And obviously, he's never going to tell his audience, his American audience in this interview, for instance, that this is an American war against Russia using Ukraine and European as proxies. He simply cannot admit that. So he goes on another kabuki, talking about a possible ceasefire, a possible, Trump is going to propose something that the Russians will like because it involves a neutral Ukraine. You cannot trust anything that the Americans, once again, that the Americans propose, talk about, right? Because they break deals. And the Russians are the first one to know that how the Americans break any possible deal anywhere. And ask the Iranians as well on the JCPOA.
The other point in his talk was so amazing that Germany has to pay to reconstruct Ukraine.
It's Germany.
In Germany, because of this conflict, they have lost this pipeline coming from Russia to Germany. Their economy is not doing great right now. And it seems that the Trump administration would force them to help Ukraine if they win. And I don't know how do they feel in Germany. Right now we have political changes in Germany, AfD. We have the candidate of far left, the Sarah Wagenknecht. It's something like, but at the end of the day, they're not happy with the current policy of Germany toward the conflict.
The whole nation of Germany is against everything that is going on. The popularity rate of the liver sausage chancellor is less than 10%. People want to get rid of this government. They still don't know how. Please go ahead.
And do you find it right now, if they get into power, this AfD, Is the United States capable of putting pressure on them, even sacrificing their economy in order to help Ukraine? Because they're not in a good shape right now.
No, you're being too diplomatic. Germany is floundering. It's not a very good shape. I am in touch with some of my German finance, tech, with connections with industrialists as well. And they say that the situation is absolutely catastrophic for Germany. Can you imagine? You have Volkswagen closing plants inside Germany. I think this is the best. This example trumps them all, in fact. And of course, the problem is if we have either a majority, let's say a majority right, AfD, or a majority left, SARA, coming to power within the next few years, there's going to be an American organized attempt at some sort of color revolution against Germany. Of course, but that's more the obvious. No, these are, you know, out of the question. Just like in France, to have the left or the right in terms of Marine Le Pen in power is absolute anathema. The French establishment does and will continue to do everything to block them. You know, so the problem is this plutocracy, this oligarchy plutocracy that controls Atlanticist relations. They think they can get away with anything because they have practically totally unlimited power. In fact, it's liberal totalitarianism from the U.S. across the Atlantic to Europe, and guided with an iron hand, in fact. What slips to them, of course, they cannot control all the narrative. And when they don't control the narrative, what do? They freak out and they try to go to war against tech companies. It's what France is doing against Telegram. And obviously what the European Union will try to do against Twitter X. So that's the problem. The greatest problem for all of us independents and all of us, the global majority, is that they still control the international financial system. And of course, in terms of NATO, they control this global Robocop. So these two things have to start collapsing. And they are collapsing, but not as fast as we all need. All of us across the global majority. And just to give you an extra idea of how demented they are, you have American think tanks already doing papers, theorizing, and talking about it in the Beltway of a three-front war against Russia, China, and Iran. So how demented are these people? Well, because they live in a bubble, this is what they do. And when we have, for instance, Chinese officials at Wang Yi level or at Ministry of Defense level, etc., saying in every forum, everywhere, including last week in Vladivostok, we need to get rid of the Cold War mentality. It's very, very difficult. Cold War lasted too long, and the American ruling class still thinks in Cold War terms. Absolutely. They just replaced the Soviet Union with Russia. And now even worse. Now it's Cold War against China, so against those the red China, as they used to call it during the Cold War, remember? Not to mention Iran. Ah, those mullahs. So we have the former communists, Bolsheviks, now autocrats in Russia, the red China, and the Ayatollahs in Iran. So where are we going to go? Let's go to war against all of them. And this is what they call strategy, Nima. And I'm not joking. I am simplifying a bit, but I'm not joking. Just read their papers.
Yeah, there is an article. There was an article in the Telegraph, and written by George Allison, if I'm not mistaken. He said that right now China is the most right now is the best opportunity for China attacking Russia, because Russia is so much involved in Ukraine. And you think, how, what in the world are you talking about?
Man, I prefer to get my foreign policy inputs from a cat. At least cats are wise individuals, you know. Well,
and you, at the end of the day, when you look at the current face of the European Union, because we had Hungary together with Slovakia, they're putting a lot of pressure on these two countries to get in line with their policy, while they're having in their country, Germany, France, they're having a lot of changes. A lot of people are not happy with the current face, but they've been able to put pressure on Hungary and Slovakia. Do you think that how much more they can do this? Because with the changes that are happening in these countries, that would not be possible for such a long time. And if Donald Trump wins in the United States, that would hugely change the situation in the European Union.
Absolutely, because it will accelerate the parallel collapse of the European Union and the European Commission and NATO. And that's why, in fact, this is the number one interpretation of Darth Vader, Dick Cheney himself supporting Kamala Harris. This is what he really said, obviously. Cheney was never very, very good as an orator, and he was never a diplomat, of course, and he was never good at expressing himself in detail. But this is essentially what he said. What he said, that Trump is the greatest danger to American democracy, that's it. Because he will accelerate the absolute debacle of the EU and NATO at the same time. And obviously, the Europeans are stupid enough not to see that, of course, because they live under a bubble. They are, it's a total vassalage syndrome, where in less than 2 years they lost any hint of sovereignty that they might have had before. They are seeing their economies being completely destroyed. In the case of Germany, it's the most Germany was dreaming 3 years ago, for instance, of becoming one of the top. They were already. We're going to become maybe one of the top two trade commercial powerhouses on the planet. They thought they could do better than China, for instance, or even better than the US. And now they are in an absolutely sorry state, where they essentially would have to beg Russia to start buying cheap Russian energy again in the near future. And of course, the only thing that the European Commission in Brussels controls is the narrative. And even that is not enough anymore. They had to come up, for instance, with the Digital Services Act, which is a new Orwellian conception, to start regulating the debate online, because they see that too many Europeans are starting to have the wrong ideas, independent ideas, critical ideas. No, you can't. You have to follow the dictates of the European Commission, of toxic von der Leyen or Lügen out of Germany. She lies all the time. And she sells these lies as the truth. It is neo-Orwellian, the whole thing. So when you look at Hungary and Slovakia that you just mentioned, they fall slightly apart from this construction. They are too independent. From the point of view of Brussels, Hungary is maybe worse than Russia, because they are in the EU and they are too independent. They are basically Hungarian nationalists. So that creates for them a gigantic problem, and they don't know how to manage, because if you go to Brussels and you talk to the people who work at the Commission, they all have the same little window vision. They are simply incapable of thinking outside the box. And that proves in the whole tsunami of sanctions against Russia, which is destroying their economies, and they still keep every month or whatever more sanctions. So, you know, this process of the disaggregation of the EU is inevitable, is going to become even more acute in the next few months and years. And the disaggregation of NATO is because NATO members are going to look at NATO 2030 or horizon of a war against Russia, and they're going to say, no, we're not going to be part of it. So it will inevitably splinter, and we will be left with what? The lunatics. London, Warsaw, the Scandinavians, and the Baltics.
Yeah. What's interesting to see that in Russia, it seems that they're totally understanding what's going on in the United States, and they don't consider if Trump wins, that would hugely change the face of the conflict in Ukraine. Medvedev was talking about this, that Trump is not capable of doing this because he was responsible for INF-3D, withdrawing from INF-3D. His administration put a lot of sanctions on Russia and sent more weapons to Ukraine. I don't know why there are many people are thinking, together with Orban, who's so optimist about what Trump would do if he wins, but it doesn't seem that he would be capable of doing what he's talking about right now about the conflict in Ukraine. What's your understanding? Do you think at the end of the day, the deep state would let him to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine?
Of course not, Nima, because this conflict was basically conceptualized by the deep state. This is a deep state war against Russia. The this is the big picture. This is the big picture up there, you know. If we're talking to Jupiter, what's the story? Jupiter will say, oh, this is a deep state war against Russia. That's what it is, with different levels going down the pyramid, you know. But from the point of view of the American elites as a whole, and that's bipartisan, essentially, much more the Democrats, but also many Republicans would agree. It's the same old story. They are a danger. They used to be Bolsheviks. Now they are autocrats. And, you know, they cannot have all those riches, all that wealth over there. We have to go there and take it from them. So this is the rationale, in fact, that we will never see explicitly anywhere except by an absolute idiot like Lindsey Graham, who actually said that a few weeks ago about the trillions of dollars of Ukraine unexploited wealth. Yes. And they happen to be most 90% at least in Donbass, which the Americans don't control. So that adds desperation to the whole Project Ukraine derailing, you know. And of course, once again, coming back to the beginning of our conversation, it's very easy for the Americans to deploy all that because they have two patsies doing the actual fighting for them. Ukrainian soldiers, devastation of Ukraine in population terms, sociologically, anthropologically, you name it. And of course, the vassal Europeans inside NATO. And some with more rabid hyenas than others. And now this German government is going to pay the price because the population finally is connecting the dots between Germany going into the abyss and Wunderwaffen after Wunderwaffen after mega aid packages to Ukraine. Money that Germany doesn't have. For instance, in Bangkok, I live right in front of the Deutsche Bank Tower. You know that the Deutsche Bank Tower is empty because they had to fire everybody. So Deutsche Bank doing business in Southeast Asia went down like this. I'll see it around the world, Deutsche Bank operations around the world. And by the way, Deutsche Bank is already bankrupt for a long time. It's being saved by the German government. It's the degree of how deaf, dumb, and blind they all are, these Atlanticist elites, and especially the so-called political leadership in Brussels, in the European Commission, but European Parliament, nobody gives a damn about the European Parliament, you know. But the European Commission is very dangerous because they dictate policy. They write policy and dictate policy. For instance, I know people in the European Commission who actually write sanctions against Russia. Very well-paid bureaucrats, gigantic salaries, gigantic pensions, they don't pay taxes, etc. They're paid to do that, you know. So it's a gigantic 28,000 at least functionary bureaucracy in Brussels. This is what they do. They legislate on how many cows you should have here and there, you know, what's the price of cheese anyway, you know, and sanctions anywhere. And of course, now control of the internet, because they are, I would say, pathetic enough not to have created a single social network. Europe has less than zero social networks. So what is their plan? Ah, let's regulate the others and let's try to take over one of them. That's what it is. It's really, the whole thing is so pathetic that, you know, after a while you say, well, what am I doing here? You know, let me exile myself in the South Pacific, in a beautiful island away from everything. And we don't see many ways of changing the system, you know, apart from a meteorite falling on Earth. To change the way they control this, they control not only the international financial system, which at least we have a counterpower. The BRICS, we're going to try to establish a parallel system. And but their control, their Atlanticist control of the military machine and this obsession that they need to rule the world, even though they cannot anymore. This is not going to disappear like this, unfortunately.
And when you look at the behavior of the European Union, do you think that they're thinking in terms of the relationship with Russia, it's reversible? That's why they're so irrational, illogical when it comes to Russia. It seems to me that whenever they're thinking that if this conflict ends, whenever they ask Russia, let's go after some sort of, let's find our way to have a better connection, they think that Russia is so willing to have a better relationship with them. That's why they're not thinking right now to get out of this conflict in Ukraine. They're thinking that everything is reversible. But it doesn't seem that would be the case when this conflict is over on the part of Russian government.
No, but because there was never any plan B, Nima. The main actors in the EU and the main actors in NATO, European actors in NATO, basically they followed plan A established by the Americans. We're going to go there. We're going to provoke them. They're going to invade. Then we have our ultra well-trained, best NATO army ever that we trained for 8 years non-stop. They're going to smash that piece of shit, a Russian army. We're going to blockade their economy. We're going to blockade them from SWIFT. In a few months, their economy will be absolute disaster. There will be internal rebellion. There are going to be protests all over Russia. They're going to depose Putin. And then we put our own vassal over there, and we take over Russia. This essentially, and it's not a joke, this was plan A, and there was never a plan B. And that's where we are now, Nima, because they still don't have a plan B, except something that I coined a few days ago as a war of terror. What they are doing now against Russia, of course, Bankova in Kiev, with NATO organizing everything and with the tacit approval in the background by the Americans, is a war of terror against the Russian Federation, including at non-stop attacks on civilians. That's it. Because they know they're on the battleground. That's it. You know, it's not game over yet, but it will be game over in a matter of months. Or let's say the spring of 2025, maximum. That's it. So in historical terms, this will go down. I can't imagine historians by the end of this century writing about this whole thing. And of course, comparing with the previous Western incursions against Russia. Swedes, Napoleon, Hitler. And this one will be probably the most pathetic of them all.
Yesterday, we've learned that the Swiss government was approaching China and Brazil and asking them for their peace plan for the conflict in Ukraine, which was rejected by Brazil and China. And the question is, why they're looking for a peace plan on the part of China and Brazil? What does it mean? Because Russia, if they want a substantial negotiation, they have to talk with Russia directly. In your opinion, why the Swiss government is doing this right now?
Very simple. I'll give you a neutral short answer, Nima. Splitting bricks from the inside. This is Roman Empire, British Empire, copied by American Empire. Divide and rule. There's nothing new under the sun for 2,000 years.
And the other thing would be Turkey, just to wrap up this session. I think Turkey is so important right now in the Middle East. They're going to be part of BRICS. When it comes to their foreign policy, they're totally confronting the United States and NATO in the Middle East. It's called alliance, but it's not that much of alliance if we look at it closely. And yes. Do you think that Turkey, at the end of the day, it seems to me that Turkey would leave NATO, but nobody knows when they're going to do this. And do you find it, is that possible in your mind?
Nobody knows what's in Erdogan's mind, Nima. This is one of the, I would say this is one of the mysteries of the universe. We know that he's a very good, he's a master of equilibrium. He hedges his bets all the time. He's a very cunning politician. No ideological judgment. He's a very, very cunning politician. What we can, with a degree of certainty, we can say that he has been studying the chessboard carefully, especially this past year or so. He's actually, he now knows which way the wind is blowing. He now knows that BRICS is the real deal, linked to the other multilateral organizations in Eurasia. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasia Economic Union, from the point of view of the Chinese, Belt and Road projects all across Eurasia, including in Turkey. Obviously, he said, well, what am I doing here with this bunch of NATO lunatics? The thing is, if that happens, major if, how Turkey is going to manage this switch? Nobody has an answer for that. I'll be going to Istanbul next month, and I want to get at least some tentative answers from my Turkish interlocutors on the spot. So after that, we should have this conversation again, Nima, because I'm sure they're going to tell me details about what's really going on in the presidential palace with Erdogan, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Turkish business interests, because this is very important. Entering BRICS from the point of view of the Erdogan system, which is basically a bunch of very greedy and wealthy trading people, commerce-minded people. They are looking at BRICS as trading opportunities, commercial opportunities that they don't have in the West. So this will be a very important factor, you know. So maybe next month we're going to have more, and this will be before the BRICS summit in Kazan. So we could have some of these answers before Erdogan goes to the BRICS summit in Kazan as one of the special guests. And in fact, he forced himself to essentially Putin and Xi said, look, I want to go and I want to talk substance with you. And the Russians and the Chinese said, oh, of course, you're more than welcome. But of course, the Russians didn't know that they are dealing with a very shifty character. Nobody can trust anything that Erdogan does or says, you know. But if he's really reading the facts on the ground and he's scanny enough to do that, he knows that for Turkey and not only BRICS and IMA, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they're observers and they want to be part of the table, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They know that the future is Eurasia. No question.
Yeah. And from 9/11 to the axis of resistance.
Oh my God.
What
this
happened?
Go for hours with this.
What happened in the forever wars in these 23 years?
Oh my God. I tried to do a resume in a podcast to my Brazilian and Lusophone audience all over the world. And well, the short version was a half an hour, Nima. So with you, I'll give you the ultra short version, like in Hollywood. Yeah, okay. Make a pitch for your movie with 25 words. So this is how people sell movies in Hollywood. This is how it works. Okay, I'll try to a little more than 25 words. We had a shift that is, I would say, it's intergalactic in terms of how important it is, especially over the past year. It started a few years before. We can say that maybe it started with the Russian entry into the Syrian theater of war in 2015. That's one possible date. But it really started when everything that General Soleimani was conceptualizing and establishing, facts on the ground, his connections with commanders everywhere, how he interacted with Syrian, Lebanese, Iraqis, and Yemenis. And of course, we had what happened last year, October 7th, Gaza, Israel. And now we have the axis of resistance completely burying what was supposed to be the paradigm of the young 21st century and everything, the rationale that would guide everything for the rest of the 21st century, according to the neocons and the ziocons, which was 9/11 and the war on terror, which they declared on the night of 9/11. The war on terror, the first time we had this exploding on TV screens everywhere, was 11 p.m. New York time on 9/11. So this means that obviously this was already planned way in advance. Of course, because 9/11 itself was the famous Pearl Harbor moment that the neocons were imploring 2-3 years before, 4 years before, start from 98 at least, 3 years before. So when they had their Pearl Harbor, they knew exactly what to do next. Cut to General David Petraeus going to the Pentagon and getting the memo. Look, our plan is to get seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq. And this was way before. This was still in 2001. So we had the whole of 2002 to prepare the terrain for Iraq, shock and awe in 2003, and then everything else. They lost with Hezbollah against Israel in 2006. That was already a setback. But they kept going on Libya, Syria, etc. And then one day the Russians looked at the chessboard. They said, oops, no. We're going to Syria. And that started to unravel the whole project. Because in the minds of the neocons, Syria was the stepping stone to the war against Iran, to destabilize Iran. If you destabilize Syria, very important ally, we can go and destabilize Iran or go to war against Iran. So the whole thing, we can say that from 2015, the whole thing started going down. And General Soleimani, the next 2016, 17, 18, 19, yes, the next 4 or 5 years, Soleimani put in place the whole organization of the axis of resistance. It's not an accident, obviously, that he was assassinated at the start of our decade, on January 3rd, 2020. What I described in one of my books as the raging 20s. Well, the raging 20s started with a murder ordered by the deep state. And Trump just, he had to sign the bill. Trump didn't even know who Soleimani was, certainly. But the deep state said, look, we have to kill this guy. This guy is the most dangerous of all of them. And at least that they knew that Soleimani was immensely dangerous because of his capacity of organizing this sprawling axis of resistance. This is something that I learned before the assassination in Iran, when I visited Iran before COVID. One of my best connections was a Syrian general that worked under Soleimani in Syria. And he told me amazing stories about it and how Soleimani was mega respected by everybody and his capacity of, with very simple moves, organize an incredibly detailed and complex chessboard, basically to say, look, we have two objectives. Smash Israel in terms of making Israel unlivable and expel the Americans from West Asia. What's happening now, Nima, and all of you, our audience? We are right in the middle of it. And this was conceptualized by this genius that was assassinated in the beginning of the decade. So that adds a little bit of flavor to all of you of how desperate the deep state is and the Israelis are. Because they can kill everybody in, they can kill everybody. I'm sorry to say something like this, but they can kill everybody in Gaza, in West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria. This is not going to change anything because this process is already ongoing. And the people who were killed, the ones who will be born, they will keep feeding their resistance forever, literally. You know, it's a dead end street for this ethos of forever wars. So the way I see it after 24 years and the fact that I was involved inside the forever wars even before they started, I was in Afghanistan and Pakistan before 9/11. I interviewed Massoud before he was killed. The plot to snatch Osama bin Laden, we learn about this in Peshawar in Pakistan. So that was the story of my life for the first part of the decade, in fact. I was following this thing from the inside. And what I learned from it and something that I can share with you and everybody is that nobody would expect during the 2000s or even the beginning of the 2010s, that this rationale, this conceptualization of the war on terror as preparing the way or paving the way for the new American century would collapse completely. And now it has collapsed completely because the axis of resistance has the initiative. And that explains why the Americans are losing their forever war in West Asia. The Israelis are losing their forever war in West Asia, even if they are killing every Palestinian in sight. And why the Americans also are losing their war in Novorossiya, because once again, they underestimated the enemy. But the enemy never underestimates the empire. The enemy prepares to fight the empire, which is the case of the axis of resistance. It took years, and it took a mastermind, absolutely brilliant, like General Soleimani. But he pulled it off.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Muito obrigado, Pepe.
You're the best. Thank you so much.
Grande prazer, como sempre. Você sabe isso.
Enorme prazer. Cuide-se. Hein? Você está num lugar calmo, pelo menos.
Yeah, é, muito calmo.
Ok, abração.
Beijo. Bye-bye.
Tchau, tchau. Enorme. Tchau, tchau. Tchau, tchau.